The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Welcome to According to Flint, the innovative podcast reaching beyond the Western demographic with stories, humor, and interviews. Now here's your host, Flint Rasmussen.
Welcome to another episode of According to Flint, of course, and getting back to our kind of in our wheelhouse a little bit, back to our roots, back to what we do every day, and happy and honored to welcome the 1992. Wow, that was so long ago. The 92 PRCA World Champion Bull Rider, not only a nine-time PBR World Finals qualifier, but a founder of the PBR in a 2017 Pro Rodeo Hall of Fame inductee, Hall of Famer, Mr. Cody Custer. The fence is fixed. The beer is cold. All is well in your world right now, huh, Cody?
All good. Just the fence is not finished yet, but I'll go back to that after we chat.
Well, I'll keep you as long as I can then. So then you don't have to. So is every guy, I remember as I was writing some notes and writing it down, I write Cody Custer. Is every guy with the initials CC, every guy with those initials CC Ryder? You and Clint Corey?
Yeah, sounds like it, yeah. Me and Clint Corey were a pair, but now there's a bunch of them, I guess.
So you got some, I've been watching on Facebook, you got some baby calves, some bucking bulls. They're colorful and have big horns, which makes, the cattle business a lot of fun when they're like that.
Yeah, I don't really have a program here. I got a handful of cows and I've always got bulls around. So who knows who breeds what? So I don't know how they're bred, but, anyway, we got five on the ground and four of them are bull calves, and I got three more left to calves. So we'll see what happens.
Do you know what's the dad? What's the sire? Anything I know?
I don't know. Like I said, I just keep them all together. So I got there's been 10 or 12 different bulls with them. So I don't know.
Nobody likes those kind of girls. You know,
yeah,
those kind of heifers. The bulls are talking amongst themselves.
Exactly.
Hey, I saw you, and I'll talk about more about your memorial roping. I saw you in Wickenburg, your memorial roping for your dad, Jim, and Danny, and Aaron, but more than that, out in Wickenburg, you're the native son of Wickenburg, Arizona. Holy cow, yeah. Cody, that place is going crazy. That's a different place than where you grew up.
Right. In some ways it's still a little bit the same, but it's quite a bit different. And I mean, everybody that wants to rope shows up there in the winter. So, I mean, that's the place to be if you want to be a roper. And there's big money stakes ropings, and you can rope every day of the week within 30 miles of Wickenburg.
Yeah.
I mean, it's crazy, all the arenas and stuff. So
my girls have spent winters there. They rope every day. They either team rope, breakaway rope. I think they even entered a goat tying jackpot one day.
Yeah, I don't doubt it.
I can go
happening there.
I can go to eat lunch at Wickenburg, Arizona, and I will know more people at Wickenburg at lunch than if I go to Shoto, Montana. It's like a convention. It's like a convention of guys with no thumbs.
Yeah. And the bad thing is I see people there that I know, but out of their element, I'm not sure who they are. And it bothers me because I've got a really good excuse. I've been hit in the head a few times, so I kind of use that. But you know, when you see somebody in Wyoming in their element, you automatically know who they are. But I see somebody down there and I'm like, I know that person.
I don't know.
I've just gotten good now where I just say, hey, what's your name? And sorry, it might be somebody I've known for 30 years. They look at me like I'm dumb. I did that to Derek Clark. I did that to Derek Clark. His brother got inducted into the Cowboy Hall of Fame last year. And I hadn't seen Derek for a long time. And, man, he looked familiar. He had lost a lot of weight, you know. And I had said, tell me your name. And he gave me some pretty good pretty good commentary. And I knew who he was as soon as he said what he said. Anyway.
They're out of context. Yeah. I'm the same way.
Yeah. Wickenburg's just, I mean, in our lifestyle, the way we do that, we see a lot of people out of context. So it's kind of tough. I envy the guys that remember everybody's names, you know, and that's a big thing, really. If people remember your name, it's
something special. I'm terrible. That's why I call everybody buddy. Hey, buddy. Hey, pard. Hey, pal. Hey, sport. So I want to, with you, I'm around you a lot. We talk about different things. You and I have discussed a lot of things. We talk about family. And so coming into this today, first thing first, you are the second guest on this podcast that has sat out and recorded on his porch. The first one was a guy named Justin McBride. Okay.
Oh yeah.
And the entire time have you heard of him? He had a rooster. He had a rooster and the entire show, this rooster crowed. And so you don't have roosters. What do you got? You got anything that's going to come into play?
My daughter's little dog is at the door at the inside the house barking right now. So,
well, you're okay. Dogs aren't, it wasn't as bad as roosters. Apparently since that day, the rooster died. He finally killed the rooster. So we're good. But you know, I introduced you as a founder of the PBR. And I think one reason I wanted to have you on is I think you can give me a feel. We always hear, even a guy in my position that's been around a long time, you always hear 20 bull riders got together. They chipped in $1,000, da, 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 da. But I've never really got in on kind of the progression of all that and the feel, the tone, how the meeting started, who kind of rallied the troops there and what was the feel of what was going on there?
Okay, so everybody that's followed bull riding for long enough, they know who Bull Riders Only is. And there was, at the time, this was in 1990, 1991, there was some standalone bull riding events and they were, you know, like Del Rio and there was a couple in Utah that the Gilberts had done. And there was, I don't know who else there, Alan Jacoby did some, and there was a handful of people that did standalone bull riding events. And what the deal was, or here's one piece of the story. When we went to those events, we didn't have insurance unless we had our own insurance, which as a bull rider, it's nearly impossible to get insurance. So Wasey Cathy, broke his arm, I believe at one of those standalone events, and it cost him going to the NFR that year. He was qualified. And then insurance wise, it cost him a bunch of money to get it fixed. And anyway, so that kind of was one of the things that we felt like, we're going and they're selling tickets on our name and we have no say so in the event, you know, how much money's added, what the stock is, the bullfighters that are there, the, you know, having insurance and stuff like that. So that's one little piece of the puzzle. Shaw Sullivan put together the Bull Riders Only, and they had a meeting in Denver in January of 1991. And unfortunately I wasn't able to make the meeting. I had my circuit finals that weekend. So I showed up at Denver on Monday and got handed a contract that was, I don't know, probably 10 pages long. And I briefly looked at it and it was a lot of legal jargon that I didn't really understand. And I was told that I needed to sign the contract by Wednesday. And I said, well, which Wednesday are you talking about? And he said, day after tomorrow. And I said, I'm not signing this without my attorney, you know, taking a look at it. And basically he said, we can do it without you. And I handed him the contract back and told him bye-bye. And so 91 was the first year of the Bull Riders only, and I didn't go to them. I wasn't invited and didn't go. And so Cody Lambert one day asked me, he said, well, how come you don't go to the Bull Riders only? And I said, well, I didn't sign their contract. And he kind of chuckled because there was a handful of them that did sign a contract. And basically the contract just gave them full rights to everything, to your name, your likeness, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And I didn't agree with that. And Cody just kind of laughed. He said, oh, there's several other guys going that didn't sign the contract. I said, oh yeah, really? That's nice. Well, Cody Lambert, Tuff Hedeman, Jim Sharp, Ty Murray, I don't know who all, there was probably most of the guys told them that if I didn't get invited to the Bull Riders only, they weren't coming. And so what it did is it made us understand that we had power in numbers, you know. And so so I got invited in 92, and I was the champ of Bull Riders only in 92, so they made a mistake, but not really. It was you know, we were all in this deal together. You know, we were all out there making a living riding bulls, mm-hmm. away from our families, you know, for 300 days a year or whatever. And we just felt like coming together would help us financially, you know, in our quest to make a living riding bulls, not to mention that it, you know, would trickle down to next generations and stuff like that. And so basically with that, I think that kind of catapulted us to come together and organize. And so that meeting was basically in, I believe it was in April of 91 when we, was it 91, 92, I believe.
92.
April of 92, we came together. It was in Scottsdale, Arizona at a standalone bull riding that was, called the Justin Bull Riding.
I remember that.
Alan Toby. I believe Alan Toby put it on. And, I think that's who it was. Maybe it wasn't Alan.
No, I think it was. Actually, I think it was, because that went on even after when it became a PBR in Houston early in my career. Yeah.
So anyway, I think what it did is it just made us all get together, and we stuck together, you know, the guys that anteed up that day in the room, and it was 20, I'm going to say maybe, I don't know how many guys were in the room that day. I know there was probably like 23 guys that anteed up and invested in it. Mm-hmm. And we had Brian McDonald was our secretary, and he came to some of the bull ridings and secretaried out of the trunk of his car. And it was pretty, you know, pretty, what do you call that? Just old school, you know.
Yeah.
There wasn't a whole lot of organization to it. There was a guy named Sam Applebaum who was, mm-hmm. he was involved in the Winston tour back in the PRCA, and we all knew him. And anyway, so we pulled him in to kind of help us negotiate some stuff. And I wasn't in some of the meetings, but I heard a lot of stuff, and it was pretty rugged. He went in there. He's a little short guy, and he had a little short man syndrome. But he went in there and told them what we wanted, you know, and we all stuck to it. And so that's kind of how the whole thing started. We did have a finals in 93 at Fort Worth. Actually, you know, that I think we formed in 90,
it was two, wasn't it?
93. It was 90. Well, I can't remember exactly. I can't remember.
I think 92, but I wasn't in on it.
I think you're right. Well, our first finals we had in Fort Worth. And we didn't structure it and have a crown a world champion that year.
Right.
But there was a finals in Fort Worth, and I don't even remember who won that. But then 94 was our first season with a series and a world champion. And that, of course, that's Adriano came over. And,
yeah.
Too bad we couldn't have kept him out of the country.
Man, he ruined it for everybody, that guy, didn't he? You know, there's going to be a lot of people that don't get the sarcasm. Like, oh, listen to these guys cussing Adriano. But
no, hey, Adriano, the first time I ever saw Adriano, he showed up in Tucson in 1993 at the rodeo.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And I think he had his permit and he won the rodeo. And then he had to go back to Brazil. I was like, man, I'm glad that guy left.
Wasn't the Tucson rodeo story? It seems like either Cody Lambert or Jerome Robinson, somebody told me, here comes this Brazilian guy, not a word of English. And Charlie Sampson, they want to interview him on the TV, and Charlie Sampson steps up, world champ, and says, I'll translate for you. Oh, okay. And they go on TV and all he did was yell at him. They want to know if you, is there, I'm sure that's the story, isn't it?
That could be. That's funny. Well, see, Charlie met him in Brazil. That's how he got over here.
Okay. Yeah.
And I believe Charlie probably had a bull riding school or something over there, but he met Adriano over there and Adriano came over. So, but, you know, the history of the PBR, just basically, it was a bunch of guys trying to make a living, and, our sport was going to another level, and the promoters were making all the money, and we didn't think that was really the way it should be. So, you know, so basically we just came together as a collective bargaining group and made it work, you know. And, you know, I think anybody arrogant enough to say we were the smartest guys on the planet, which I've heard, we were just in the right place at the right time. There was a lot of things that came into play. TNN, the Nashville network, they had filmed the bull riding at Guthrie, and it was actually Lane Frost got that rolling, and it was Freckles Brown Memorial bull riding. And so when we had that, I'm not sure we didn't have it just as a Freckles Brown, but after Lane got killed, it was the Lane Frost Freckles Brown Memorial. And they had Bud Light came in, and I think because of the relationship Tuff had with them, sponsor wise, Bud Light came in and they put up $30,000, and there was 30 of us, and we paid $1,000 fees. So they matched our money. So we were riding for $60,000, which was huge. And it was a three go round, get on two bulls on the first day, and then a long and a short go on the last day. So there's 30 guys, and anyway, I don't even know who won it that year.
Hey, you know,
I'm wrong or something.
When you say that money, they put up 30, you guys, 30 of you put up 1,000, 60,000 at it.
Yeah.
What's interesting is as we record this, I'm getting ready to get on a plane and go to a touring pro PBR, a one night touring pro PBR that I've always done at Clovis, California, Clovis Rodeo. Oh, yeah. They kick off their week. I used to do the rodeo, so I still go. A one night touring pro, not a main tour level, and they're adding $40,000.
Yeah.
So I know time and inflation. However, it really shows, you're talking a one-day touring pro lower level event, and they're adding almost as much as you guys had at the big Guthrie, Oklahoma on your main tour.
Right. And inflation wise, I mean, it really doesn't even add up.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? If you're talking those numbers, you're talking 100,000, maybe. I don't know. Yeah. You know, I don't know what the inflation rate is,
yeah. but it's good. You know, it's good guys have that opportunity though. You know, that now guys can go on a Wednesday night and win 12, 13 grand before they hit Nampa, Idaho, for instance.
Right. So the thing now, the difference now from when I was, you know, 20 something is there's a lot more guys leaving the sport with something to show for it. And back then it was, you know, I hung out at a golf tournament the other day with Mike Bandy, guy, you know, I mean, one of my heroes, one of the guys that's a generation and a half ahead of me. But he told me that the first time he went to NFR that the go rounds were paying $650. so it's gotten a lot better.
Yeah. it never, I think there's a wrong impression, especially back then. And I see it now because I had a really good rodeo career and still love rodeo and have a connection. And I have a, love what I do in the PBR. It was just a different move. But you guys, what was going on was the bull riders, you guys saw, and at that time, that I call those the glory years of bull riding, the NFR. When you, the names you said with Jim and Tuff and Clint Bronger and you, I mean, that was to me the golden age of bull riding. Right. What you guys were doing was never intended as we're getting out of rodeo. This is anti-rodeo. It supplement, it was in addition to making it to the NFR, correct?
Yeah, and so the perception was that we were a threat to rodeo, and I remember when we showed up at the NFR in 92, because yeah, we did form in 91. So when we showed up in 92 at the NFR, we all had our jackets with black sleeves, red, the front and the back was red with a big square on the back with that says professional bull riders. And it was, there were some bad things said. And I mean, they thought we were trying to do something against rodeo, and heck, that's where we all came from. It wasn't that we were trying to do something for ourselves and the future. And so, I mean, the perception was we were trying to do something bad, but really, looking back on it, it spread across the board for the whole sport of sure. rodeo. You know, I think just because it made people realize that more television and more sponsors and more exposure was going to be the thing, you know, mm-hmm. that would propel it to where it's at nowadays.
I still look at it. I still think that if people can watch bull riding, any kind of bull riding, just so happens PBR is on TV every week during the season. But if people, every time people see it on TV, when the rodeo comes to town, well, let's go watch that. I still am a believer in that. Not everybody is, but that it does trickle down. It has, I mean, look what it did. The PRCA has the Extreme Bulls Tour. Well, that wouldn't have happened without a standalone bull riding tour. It all feeds the other.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I think that, like the Winston tour was just a little bit ahead of my time. In 86, I didn't get to be a part of it. In 87, I was going to be on a team, and they 86 was the last year of it. So
they 86'd it.
Yeah. 86. And, I believe that if that wouldn't have gone away, I don't think the PBR would exist. I think rodeo would have stayed, just where guys weren't splitting off from the rodeo deal. Hmm.
So that would have
money would have, I think it would have propelled it to higher levels if that would have stayed intact, because it was a televised series of the best guys. It was just exactly what the PBR did, but it was rodeo. And when that went away for several years, it opened the door for us to be able to, you know, for what happened to happen. I mean, I say for us, we were just in the right place at the right time, and all the things came together that made it all work. So,
yeah, timing was good. I had Randy Bernard on here. We talk about that same thing. It just, the timing was right. The situation was right. You know, I talk about that all the time when people will bring up that, man, we used to go to St. Louis and sell it out two nights, 15,000 people. Well, that was at a time when there weren't, when you talk about, there was a few standalone bull riding events. You can go anywhere in the country, pretty much any month of the year, and there's a standalone bull riding event. And I've always said, that's why PBR, and I say we, when I talk PBR, that's why we have to do something that makes it a little better, a little different, a little better competition to get people there, because they can go watch bull riding anywhere now. Right.
Right. And the other thing, you know, there's a lot of criticism of bull riding today, but there, and bull riders, I hear a lot of older guys talking about the young guys and talking crap about them and stuff. And I don't, the way I look at it, there's always been guys that don't.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Reach their potential, no matter what. There's always been that, okay? But what I see is a big problem is that everybody's so spread out, and the best guys aren't coming together every time. There's guys that rodeo that should be coming to PBRs, mm-hmm. and there's guys that are in the PBR that should just be rodeoing.
Right.
And so I think everybody's so spread out, and there's so many different associations, and there's guys, and there's always been guys that were just regional guys that didn't ever leave their region and could have been a household type name, but now they have a place to go and never leave. And so I think they never leave and go reach their potential. I think there, you know, if there was some way to bring everybody together where the best guys were competing against the best guys every time, and not saying not knocking anybody, because mm-hmm. obviously the PBR is great and the young guys in there are great and they're all athletic, and they, you know, the ones that are excelling because they're putting the time and effort into it, and it's not a, you know, it's not an accident that those guys are great. But I think there's a lot of guys that don't ever reach that greatness because they're comfortable, whether it be a bottom feeder at the PBR that just makes the finals every year and never does anything, mm-hmm. or whether it be a guy that kicks their butt every time he gets on, but he never leaves his state, you know. So, I don't know. There's a lot of things. I talk to a lot of kids about what they, you know, like when I'm doing schools and stuff mm-hmm. like that, I talk about, there's guys that you know that are household names that have never decided to go beyond mediocre. You see them, mm-hmm. and it's been that way from the start. I'm not going to name any names because it's none of my business. But there's some guys that once they realize they got to step to the next level and do what it takes, it shows up and they're riding. And a perfect example is Cooper Davis. As you know, I don't know if you know the story, but
completely, it's a great story.
He went to the NFR mm-hmm. maybe once or twice. I don't know. But when he transitioned over to the PBR, he was kind of out of shape and wasn't rock solid like he is now. Brandon Bates was his agent, and Brandon, this is the story I got. Now, I wasn't there firsthand, but yeah. Brandon told him, he said, you know, if you'd put a little effort into it and quit being a little fat boy and being happy with just being a bottom feeder, you might rise to greatness. And you know what he did? Mm-hmm. He went and dropped some weight, got in shape. And a few years later, he's the world champ, and he's a contender every year now because he went from, just being okay with having a good sponsor and being on TV every week to going, hey, I want to be great. I want to remember me as somebody that did something. And I think so many guys don't do that. They get caught up in the stardom and they never finished what they could have, you know, what got started.
I just used Cooper Davis just the other day as that example. I call some of those an also ran, just from another sport. I've taken that from other sports, but I remember when Cooper had made the NFR and he got on the big tour of the PBR, and I admit it now, I said, yeah, Cooper will be one of those guys that he'll always be on tour. He'll kind of be anywhere from 20 to 30. He'll be that guy. You know, he's a good kid. He had long hair. His face was round, kind of stocky. And he lost 35 pounds. He's a little dude. And you know what he did? He treated himself like a professional athlete.
Right.
And why is there, and you segued perfectly for me with your schools and what you mentor guys in, why is there such a stigma in especially bull riding, it's noticeable to me. A stigma about a mentor or a coach. Nobody likes the word coach. Hell, Tiger Woods has a golf swing coach. Every professional golfer does, and they're making $30 million. What's that stigma? Right. Is it that independent spirit? What is it?
Well, there's a couple of things I see, and I saw this. My oldest boy Aaron was a calf roper, and we went down to the calf roping Barry Burke roping. Yeah. And what I saw there was a bunch of guys that were past greats mentoring, like in the shoot, help talking to them kids about their start and all that stuff. And the thought occurred to me that there's a bunch of old bull riders that are piss heads that all they want to do is talk crap about the kids and don't really give their best to try to help those kids be great. And so it got me to thinking about, you know, about how important it is for the, you know, when I came along, there was guys like Denny Flynn, there was guys like, you know, Alan Jordan. There was a bunch of guys that I looked up to that were my mentors. Maybe not, I didn't call them coach, but every time I was around them, I took in everything they had to say. And I asked them questions and stuff like that. And I learned a lot of things by being, you know, I got to rodeo with, Glenn McElvay and Bobby Delvecchio in 86. And then, Ted Noose, I lived with Ted Noose and rodeoed with him. It upped my ante. It upped my game to be around those kind of guys. And it occurred to me that there's a lot of them, a lot of guys nowadays going that don't really have that mentorship. And maybe, you know, the PBR kind of has a little bit of a stigma of you're your own man and stuff, instead of, you know, like rodeoing, you got in the car and you rode for hours with guys. And, you know, I got to get in with Lane and Tuff and them guys when I was young and listen to them and talk to them and learn some stuff from them. They're a few years ahead of me. And I think that didn't happen for a long time. I see it a little bit now. More some of these older guys that are, you know, that have been on tour for a while are kind of taking these younger guys under the wing and stuff. I don't know exactly what they're telling them, but, you know, take for instance, Chase Outlaw. I know JB Mooney had some really serious conversations with him back in the day. Cause he was just there for the good time. You know, and he's still kind of a little badass, but I think JB took him aside and said, "Hey man, treat this like a career, you know?" And so, I see a little more of that now in the PBR. I think there was a while there, everybody was kind of a rogue guy and really that's the part I see that's a little bit missing, I think maybe. And part of it goes back to the guys that don't ride anymore. There's so many guys that leave the sport and never look back, you know, never even have anything to do with it after they leave.
I haven't seen Chris Shivers twice in 4 or 5 years.
Well, they're going and doing other things. I mean, every guy that rode bulls and was good at it, you know, 99% of them go do something else after they ride bulls. So you can't, I mean, you got to put some effort into what you're doing after you leave the sport. So I understand some of it, but I just think some of those guys are I don't know. I just noticed the calf ropers were more connected to the younger guys.
I think time events all the way around. My girls are ropers and they get that from, they're constantly going to schools and listening to Joe Beaver and Larry D. Guy and Jackie Crawford and that whole deal. And there's that stigma of it where you're looking for help. Look what has happened a little, you know, Jess Lockwood turned 18 years old and moved from his home in Montana and went and lived with Cody Lambert. And to this day, fans, other riders, oh, right, Jess Lockwood's Cody Lambert's little baby. Oh, he does this, it. Why aren't more guys? Any rider on tour could go move in with Cody Lambert, and he'd do the same for them. And it, like Jess always said, it was more about mowing the lawn and being disciplined and getting your own laundry done, and it wasn't all about riding, but he'd do the same. There's an example right there.
Stetson Lawrence came and spent a little bit of time at my house. And, you know, not that I'm taking credit for it, but that was just right before he really started excelling. And, you know, so, and there's been some other guys. I pride myself on that, but I don't brag on it. And I don't take credit for the guy's success, because in the big scheme of things, I'm just a small piece of the puzzle.
Sure.
You know, if I've helped some guys, and I don't want to be a guy that's taking credit for their success.
You're a good piece. You're a good piece. You're that one main piece. You're a good piece of that puzzle, Cody. Hey, but when you talk about one thing I think you have been outspoken about is how young kids that want to be bull riders should establish their foundation to then become great. I'll quote you as saying, kind of, I'll paraphrase a little bit. It doesn't do kids any good to go get dick slammed 10 times in a row. You don't learn anything. You go watch kids and they're riding some stock contractor brings a bunch of 3-year-old bulls and laughs at them because he dick slams them. Kids should be getting on something that helps their fundamentals, correct?
The backstory of this whole, of my whole career is when I was, I think I was 8 or 9, something like that. We had a rodeo arena in Flagstaff, Arizona. So it was kind of a seasonal deal during the summer. We had rodeos and ropings the whole summer. Well, we had 30 head of roping steers and a set of bucking chutes. So what do you think they doubled as?
Yeah.
They were bucking, you know, they were bucking steers too. And this could be a little bit of an exaggeration, but I don't believe it is. In those 3 summers, I'll bet I got on 2,500 head of steers. And do you know how many times I hit the ground? I don't know, but it wasn't very many. Like, mm-hmm. If I hit the ground 30 times out of those 2,500 head, that might be stretching it. Huh. And so what that did for me is it gave me the foundation of riding steers, you know, riding something with some forward movement and some up and down. There was a few of them that would turn back, but not very many. And so I learned how to track one trying to get away from me, and without the strength and the athletic ability there. So by the time I got on my first bull when I was 13, there was no chance that he was going to get me on the ground, because he was just a junior bull. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the difference was, is I kind of had my, you know, I had a lump in my throat because I was getting on a bull, but he had no chance of bucking me off. And so what happened is I got prepared to start getting on a little bit stronger and bigger and more powerful athletic type animals. I think that process gets skipped nowadays, because number one, there's a lot of junior bull riding going on at 10, 11 years old rather than 13. And, so these kids are starting to get on stock that's a little bit over their head before they're ready. And so I think it's left a lot of them, you know, with either losing heart or getting hurt bad enough that they can't. And, so our generation kind of got taken care of accidentally, because there was no breeding programs and there wasn't the big, you know, there was probably a few guys that were kind of had that figured out a little bit, but it didn't trickle down into the junior associations. Because if there was a high school bull that showed up that was a 22 pointer, you never saw him again, because he went somewhere else. Yeah. And nowadays you go to a high school rodeo and there's LA, I mean, you could go put on an amateur or pro rodeo with what they bring.
Right.
And in a lot of cases, I mean, a lot of people have, okay. So because of my son, Brett, wanted to be a bull rider, and I went to the junior high finals in 2005 and I saw what was going on. I was like, oh my God, you know, they're putting these little 12, 13, 14 year old kids on these bulls that are real bulls, you know? And about got beat up that day, because there was one bull that you could have been 90 on, and this kid tried to ride him, and I mean, he did pile drive this poor kid. And the guy that owned the bull was, woo, what do you think of that? I mean, I gave him an earful, and it wasn't nice. So he's going to beat me up. Then I went and had a conversation that was a stupid, you know, guns blazing type deal with the leadership of the high school association. So I kind of burned some bridges there and had everybody pissed off at me. And so I started, you know, I started really being outspoken about it. But along the way, I started to learn to be a little more
diplomatic, maybe.
Diplomatic, yeah. And you know, and it took, like, so the high school association, the people that run the high school association, they know me, and we're in good, you know, we're good now. But there was a few years them guys hated me because it pissed me off so bad what they were doing to these kids. And so I started kind of backdoored it and started helping out with the Texas Region 1 bulls. And then I got in there and did the, you know, helped with the bulls at the state, and then gained their I don't know if it's respect, but I gained their blessing to start coming. So I've done the junior high nationals for the last 4 years. I got it again this year, which last year we didn't have a finals, but right. in those years, you've had to ride two bulls to make the short go. And that never happened before that.
Yeah.
So I pulled the bulls back to where they were. It was more of a riding contest than a drawing contest. And so anyway, my influence and not just mine, and some other people think the same way I do, has really helped a lot of people that don't have a child that's going to get killed if you don't take care of them. They're starting to see it a little bit more because we've kind of infiltrated the bull riding deal. So yeah. This year I've got the contract on the junior high nationals. I've got the contract on the Little Britches finals. I've got possibly got the contract on the junior NFR. I will take bulls to the YBR in Abilene. Mm-hmm. So I've gained enough, trust of people. Yeah.
Completely.
And so it's kind of cool. I mean, I still see things every once in a while that make me go, God dang, that ain't the best. But, there's a miniature bull association called the IMBA, the International Miniature Bull Riders. And they contacted me about getting involved with them. And so we've had a lot of conversations and basically they put me as the CEO, which I don't know what that means other than just, I'm just kind of a face of the deal and kind of sponsor relations type deal. And we signed the contract on our finals in Reno in November, right the weekend after the PBR finals. And so we're going to have a big event in Reno, our finals. And in my mind, I want to try to make it where there's 10,000 added.
Yeah.
Per age group. There's four age groups. So that's kind of what my brain's saying, which we might not get there this year, but we've got some ideas that's going to help make it a big deal. So
as you were talking, I remember, and I've heard other coaches say this too. I'm a big analogy to other sports guy. You know, I'm an analogies guy. And I remember when my brother was the head basketball coach at the little town we grew up in. And he said, man, you give a kid a basketball now, a little kid. And what's the first thing he does? He said, the worst thing they ever did was draw that 3-point line on a floor. First thing a kid does is go out and try to crank up a 3-pointer and he can't even get the ball there. So it screws him up. His shooting form screwed up instead of shooting layups. And I thought of that. That's all that was going through my mind. You were shooting layups with those steers and free throws. And then when it came time to shoot a 3-pointer, you had confidence. I don't know. I think that's a good analogy.
And I relate that all back to sports. Every organized sport that you have has an overriding entity that sets the precedent for how to bring them up. Bull riding, there's not that. There's never been somebody that has made a set of rules to go by to help get them to step the ladder, so to speak. But you know, you got Little League, you got you know, Pop Warner, you got all the, they really work on foundation, and they don't put them, they don't, a 6-year-old doesn't play a 12-year-old.
Right.
And essentially that's what's happened in the world of bull riding is these young guys, you know, these kids that are just kids are getting on bulls that are not.
Yeah. That's out. Yeah.
It's gotten better. I mean, it's gotten better, and a lot of people are seeing it, and there's still people that don't see it my way and argue with me and that, well, what about the kid that can ride? Well, who cares? The kid that can ride is still going to dominate.
He's going to win anyway.
And he's got other places to go if he really doesn't want to be there.
Yeah.
And so anyway, that's my,
you know, thought. The whole bull thing though, I've been around, I'm not one of the guys that I'm not the old guy or the young guy that holds any era as superior to the other. But I will say I look at PBR videos from the world finals in 1998 and I was there. Yeah. Now I see them from 2020 and I was there. The bulls across the board right now, I have just, as we do this, I have just come from Oklahoma City. Cody, I mean, it's unreal. Old guy can ever say bulls really bucked back harder. Hey, back.
Some of them do though. That's the thing. I mean, there was always a handful that were great like we have now, but across the boards, man, I went to some amateur rodeos with Brett when he was 17. And I was like, I'd tell somebody, hey, you know, this would be a pen of bulls at the NFR when I was going. They're like, no. I'm like, yeah, seriously. Like it's,
yeah.
It's that they face something that we didn't face. And honestly, in our mind, you know, we were making a living on bulls that were subpar. These guys nowadays, that subpar bulls don't really exist, or if they do, they're gone. They send them somewhere else. And so, you know, the thing that we dreamed of, they have. And so, not to knock anything. I'm just saying we got on a lot of easy bulls along the way throughout the year. And then when we had that one bull, we had to step up and make it count. Today, they get on that bull every single time. And I'm not saying if we'd have been faced with what they're faced with today, the riding percentages would obviously have gone down. Mm-hmm. That's a no brainer. And so it bothers me when I hear them guys talking crap about the young guys nowadays, because there was always guys that didn't do what it took to be the best.
Yeah.
And that's still the scene today. I just think a lot of people forget. And there's a lot of guys that were that guy that they don't remember they were that guy.
Yeah.
You know,
that's a nice looking cow over your left shoulder, that red and white spotted. There you go. You can't plan this any better. Fox News got nothing on me. I mean, look at the background I provide. Tell me, now this might be tough and you can pluralize it. You can do whatever. Fans love to hear this. Best favorite bull or that you ever got on, or maybe the one great bull ride you remember that was your favorite, either one of those.
A bull ride of my own?
Yeah, of your own. So yeah, maybe it's a favorite bull that you got on a bunch of times, or one particular ride that you really stands out in your mind.
Well, so when we're talking about bulls, there was Pacific Bell, and you were there the day he knocked my block off at Guthrie. Were you there?
I don't know if I was there, but I know of it.
That was in 93.
Might have been before my time, but I remember. Yeah.
So Pacific Bell was Dan Russell's on the West Coast, and he was he got the Bull of the Year in 1988, and 1988 I went to the San Francisco to the Cow Palace and had to win some money there to make the NFR. I was outside the top 15, and I won the first round at the Cow Palace, and I drew Pacific Bell, the Bucking Bull of the Year that got. He got crowned the Bull of the Year that, you know, earlier that year, whatever it was, maybe a couple weeks before that. So, so I have him in the short go, and, a lot of people say, well, you had to ride him to make the NFR. Nobody really knows this, but I already had the NFR made and I knew it. And so it took some pressure off of me. I think that's why I stuck it on him, because the pressure, I don't know, maybe it might've worked the other way too, but I had some relief. Like I knew I'd made the finals. And then when I drew the bull of the year, it didn't freak me out. I was just excited. And I went and rode him. So I rode him his first trip after he got crowned bull of the year. And then he goes to the NFR and Jim Sharp rides him and Ted Noose rides him. He gets ridden the first three times as bull of the year. And I'm pretty sure Dan Russell was not very happy about that. But so anyway, that.
Yeah, but Dan Russell was never happy. Dan Russell wasn't happy about anything anyway. So
he was happy sometimes. But but anyway, that bull. So I got on that bull. That was the first time I got on him. I got on him five times, and the other four times didn't go my way. But so he was my favorite bull. He was a compact type bull. So like from my rope, where my rope set to the flank strap was just, there wasn't very much room. He was real short bodied. Hmm. He was tall and lanky, short body. And he felt really good until you got a little bit of a bind, and then it wasn't so good. But I had him at Guthrie right after I won the world, and he jerked me down. And so this shaving scar, every time I shave, I think about Pacific Bell. So he tore my bicep tendon later that year, which took me out for the whole year. And then he separated my ribs. Well, so we had a history together. He's my favorite bull.
This sounds like you describing that bull is like you saying, man, my best friend in high school was this kid. He was the best, but he kicked my ass every day. But man, did I like him.
Yeah. So as far as my favorite ride that I made was at the Bull Riders Only Finals in 1992, I got bucked off. There was four of us that came back to the top the last go round, and I had a bull called 550 Rocky, and he was the bull of the year in 92. And he bucked me off, and all four of us got bucked off. And so there was really no precedent for what to do. And so we all came together. It was me and Clint Bronger and Buddy Golden and Mark Kane.
Oh, wow.
There was the four of us. And so as like Shaw Sullivan said, well, we don't know what to do. Do we go off the last go round, which I won, or do we all get on another one? I said, well, you guys know my vote, but I'm going to go rosin my rope. I knew we were getting on another bull. And anyway, they had us go out in the arena and draw our own bull out of the hat. And when I was reaching in there, I didn't really know what bulls were in there. I think I knew Outlaw Willie was in there, but in my mind, I was like, I want the buckingest son of a gun on the planet, because I was pissed off for falling off. And I reached in there and I pulled 73 High Fives, which was a son of the great Mr. T. Mm-hmm. And when I saw I had him drawn, I was like, that's right up my alley, because I knew he was going to buck and go away from my hand, try to buck me off. And I was excited to get on him. And I was 95 points on him, won the Bull Riders Only Championship that year or that day. So that's my favorite ride. And if you go back and watch it, you can find it on YouTube. It's pretty easy to find it. It's the best ride I ever made. And something I use to, when I talk to guys about riding bulls away from their hand, I always go to that as a kind of a platform to show. Yeah. So
we get a lot, and there's so much debate of who the greatest bull rider of all time, who's the greatest bull rider you've ever seen. JB Mooney's the best, Chris Shivers, and all those guys could fit. I always say in my career, because I think it was the heart of my career, and maybe because I was better friends with him or I knew what kind of guy he was, I always say the best bull rider I saw in my career, Justin McBride. The way he did things. And if you had to pick one that you saw in person, who would you pick right off the top of your head?
Jim Sharp's going to be my pick. I mean, you can't say that, you know, McBride's not in that conversation, because I mean, heck, just watch all his videos. He was extraordinary at doing what he did. Jim was a year behind me in the PRCA, and he was kind of a guy that everybody heard of. He went around to those amateur deals and stuff when he was 17, and he won like 35,000 at open rodeos and jackpots when he was 17 years old. And I saw Jim when he first came around, and he spurred about everything he got on. Like it was just incredible to watch. And so in my mind, Jim in my mind was the greatest bull rider I ever saw, but shucks, you can't take, there's a ton of guys you can put in that conversation. And, there's a lot of guys for a lot of different reasons. JB Mooney, you can't say there's anybody that's more of a titan or whatever you want to call it. He was mm-hmm. He's a badass. He went for it every time, and you know, he probably bucked off more easy bulls than he did buckers. Yeah,
I think you're right. off of specific bull riding a little bit. But you are well known amongst all of us as a guy who leans and is proud of your faith. And you've always been one, you know, every time I talk to you on the phone, you say, God bless you, you know,
see you.
And it's just, it means something to me that you do that. Yeah. We're friends on Facebook, and there was something shared the other day. And I never knew this. I mean, I don't know the whole story. And it was the title of it. How was it, paraphrasing, how the loss of one man changed the life of another man. It was 1985. Yeah. And the guy's name was Jeff Crockett.
Yeah.
And I never knew the story. I don't know the story. How did the loss of a friend change you?
Well, so Jeff and I were rookies the same year, which was 1985. And we rodeoed together. I mean, we didn't rodeo together, but we saw each other quite often. We became pretty good friends. Jeff, in 1987, he just missed the NFR. I don't know how many spots, but he just about made the finals, and that was my first year. So he came to Vegas and stayed with me, and we had a good time. We hung out, and we had a good time. Like he was a really good friend. Right after the NFR, I had my knee operated on. And, so I had made a decision for the Lord in 1984, but really didn't really know what that meant, you know, just so in my downtime, while I was nursing my knee surgery, I started reading the Bible and just really, really investigating what it all meant, you know? And, so when I cracked back out, I was rodeoing really hard, and seemed like everywhere I was with Jeff, we were up at the same rodeos a lot. And Jeff and I, we talked a lot about the Lord, and he's kind of in the same, we were kind of in the same position. We'd made a decision, but didn't really know what it meant, you know? And, anyway, so, Jeff's wife was pregnant, and she was going to have a baby, and he was excited about that. And I mean, just his life was going good. And we had a lot of conversations about the Lord as we, you know, as we'd see each other, and it always ended up, it always came around to that. And, it was, August 28th of 1988, I was supposed to meet him and Scott Breding or Scott, Kessel mm-hmm. at, Logan, or what's the name of that town? Why can't I think of it? Anyway, just a little old rodeo in Yerington, Nevada. That's where it was at. I was supposed to meet them there. I was up the night before, and I had Scott's car, and Jeff and Scott were together, and we were all going to meet there. And I found there was a guy from Phoenix that was up that night going back to Arizona, and I hadn't seen my parents since the 4th of July. So I just left the keys to Scott's car with the secretary and went on. And, that next day, Jeff got a bull stepped on his head, and he later died that night. And, it kind of made me realize that this isn't forever, you know? And, myself and Beaver Jernigan, we got baptized the next week at Pueblo, Colorado, at the Motel 6 swimming pool. Freaking my butts off. But anyway, just my time spent with Jeff and the conversations we had and how excited he was about his wife being pregnant and him starting a family. And I didn't find this out until later, but Jeff was planning on attending the academy and becoming a sheriff, a deputy sheriff. That was what I've since spent time with his family and stuff, and his parents told me that. So that's kind of exciting. Like, he had some plans besides bull riding, but anyway, that just changed my life, and I just saw things through different eyes, and it just changed. It really changed my path, you know. And so my friendship and his death, my friendship with him and his death and his influence in my life really made an impact on me spiritually. And I can't say I didn't go a little bit to the extreme of being maybe what I call now maybe religious, you know, just where I kind of put a little pressure on people and a little more pressure than I really would like to have had, you know, done, just because I remember the guys that were like Christians and cowboy preachers that really put pressure on me, and I always felt uncomfortable around that. And so I think I went that direction for a little while, but you know, I got some friends that talk to me and tell me, hey, you never treated me any different. I knew who you were and I knew what you were doing. And Aaron Seamus is a great, you know, perfect example of that. Him and I were friends back in the day, and we did all kinds of wild, crazy stuff. And when I made my decision to step away from the party life and all that stuff and just really take my Christianity serious and not do the things I'd done, he'd always kid around and say, hey, let's go have a beer, you know, and knowing I wasn't going to. But he'd kind of rib me a little bit. And the story is we chartered a jet from Odessa at the Bud Light Cup to Hollister, California. And there was probably 12 or maybe 15 of us on this Learjet. And I was sitting next to Aaron, and I fell asleep. And when I woke up, he had my notebook out, and he's going through my stuff, 'cause he's a little like a Curious George. Yeah. Little monkey. he's looking through my stuff, and he said, hey, what's this list? His name was on a list. He said, what's this list? And I said, it's guys I pray for every day. And he's like, you pray for me? I said, yeah, every day, man. I love you, you know? And that's all. I didn't try to preach to him. I just kind of left him alone. And so down the road later on, when the circumstances were right and he made a decision for the Lord, he pulled me off and told me, he said, hey, that day, that was helpful in my deciding to investigate the Lord, you know? And so I don't know. I think there can be a lot of pressure of, I'm a Christian. I mean, you guys saw me, I was drinking a beer here. I got finished fencing a little while ago, and it was kind of warm outside, so had a little refreshment. But I just think people take it to the extreme of making other people uncomfortable in it. And I don't want to be that, because I've been the guy that's uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you and I have had some spiritual conversations and stuff, and I don't really indulge what's been said between me and anybody. And I actually did a interview for a documentary about Lane Frost, and Lane and I had some good conversation, you know, back in the day. And Lane, you know, of course he received Christ before he was killed, which was really, really an awesome deal to his family. And to, you know, I mean, you know, the Lane Frost Bibles that Clyde and Elsie give out and stuff like that. It just, so anyway, the impact, which, and I didn't share any kind of detail about what we talked about, but there's some conversations I've had with some other guys where I was trying to make them see the way I saw rather than give them room to be my friend and not, you know, not be human about it. You know what I'm saying? I think so many people get so hell-bent on saving the world. You can't do that. It's all in God's timing, and how, you know, how it all gets orchestrated is not up to me. It's up to, you know, the Father and his way of doing things. And so I don't speak a whole lot publicly anymore. I used to think I had to. I still do sometimes, but, and I help with the youth here at our church every Wednesday night that I'm home. And you know, we do all kinds of things, like, we'll take those kids down to Oklahoma City and feed the homeless and stuff. And so they got hands-on what being a good human and being a believer in Christ is. And so I just, anyway, I've changed a lot of my way of thinking. So we talk about faith and we talk about beliefs, and a lot of people make those as one. And I think my faith has never changed. My faith is in Jesus, but my belief system and the way I present it has changed over the years. And I think it will. I think it's going to continue to holler at me next year. I'll have a different look at something. You know,
I'm witness to that your beliefs and how you present it is different. And I'm completely comfortable around you and love to chat with you. And, you know, I look at people who go through loss and losing family members. And, you know, I think sometimes he gives certain people things because he knows that he can handle them. And, you know, I wrote down your dad, Jim, your brother, Danny, right? Danny. And your son, Aaron. I mean, you've gone through some loss, but here's what I like. You openly honor them. It's not something that you are afraid to talk about. Not something I can talk to you about it. And, you know, you have memorial roping for them. You do things. It's a good release, and something that faith is something to lean on to get you through that. And I think people, until they have that loss, don't understand that that's really something to grab onto to help you navigate through that stuff.
Yeah. And I mean, I take it as you know, Aaron's life, my boy, his life, my dad, my brother, Danny, those guys, their lives, are still playing out, so to speak. You know what I'm saying? And so, as yours will and mine will after we're gone, because of the people we encounter and the experiences we have with them and the stories that will get told us about us down the road and stuff like that. So I just don't want to be that guy that when I walk up into a group of people that people are hiding their beer and trying to get away from me because I'm going to preach to them. I don't do that. I decided a few years ago that I don't witness publicly. I don't do it anymore. Yeah. That's not my agenda. I won't talk to anybody, go up. I mean, I say I won't. If I know I'm supposed to, I will. But my agenda used to be try to make everybody see it the way I saw it. And ultimately, I get to witness more than I would the other way, because it always comes around to that, because people know who I am and then they start trusting me and then they open up. They start the back and forth. It's not me pressuring them into hearing something. Yeah. And I've got a lot of friends that don't want to hear it. And that's fine. I don't care. I'm not there to try to straighten anybody out. Hell, I barely straighten myself out, you know?
Well, listen, I did want to touch on that. It means a lot to me. And I know that you do things like pray for me when I've needed it, but I appreciate it. Anyway, and before I let you go, I always try to throw some thoughts in here. I wanted to have you on. I knew you'd have great thoughts about bull riding, about faith and beliefs. But more than that, I consider you my friend. And we've been around, you know, we've been around a while, Cody, CC Rider.
We're both still 28.
Yes, we are, as a matter of fact, and look good. Okay, one last thing. Yeah. Verify this, because I was just telling this story. It's lighthearted. About, we were talking about bullfighters and how now we have three bullfighters out there, and that's fairly new. It used to be two. Well, I remember when there was one, and one of the first rodeos, it was 1995 in Red Lodge, Montana, and they hired one bullfighter. It was Jeff Kobza. Remember Jeff Kobza?
Yeah.
About two bulls in, he sprains his ankle. And I'm there, and I'm not any bullfighter. I know it was you put your tennis shoes on and came out and helped me. Do you remember that at all?
I could have been. I mean, I don't know if I was any help. I probably stayed close to the fence with my hand on my hat.
So basically we were doing the same thing. So see, I'm probably right. So exactly. Anyway,
what year would that have been
95 ish. I think possibly it might. Yeah. Anyway, well, regardless,
it might not have been me in 95, but.
Well, let's just go with it. Let's just go with that. So
yeah, we were a team.
Yeah, that's right. Well, listen, I always appreciate you. I appreciate your friendship. I appreciate your family, and Stacy and the kids, and it just talking about this means a lot to me, and I appreciate the time, my friend.
Yeah, man. Thanks for having me on. I've watched your show a few times, and I have to say this is probably your best one so far.
of all the people I've had on this show, you're one of them. As a matter
there you go. That's right.
Cody, thank you, my friend.
I'm the most recent. Let's put it.
Yes, you are. Yes, you. You are. Hey, I'll see you soon. Okay.
All right. God bless you, buddy.
Thank you, Cody. Thank you. Yeah. Bye.